This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
It's a pleasure to be here with everyone tonight. What an amazing turnout. This is great. So we're all here to talk about kelp, but as we get deeper into this conversation, it'll soon be clear that this is really a discussion centered around climate change and its impact on natural systems we've perhaps taken a bit for granted lately. So dating back to 2013, when I was just finishing up undergrad, one thing has been constant across all my research, and that's the impact of climate change. So it's 2024 now. It's been a short while since I started, but climate change has somehow touched every project that I've worked on. And that's the backdrop to our discussion today. And so on that note, before we even start talking about kelp, I want to share the path that finally brought me here to the forest. So back then in 2013, I was studying the life history of baby market squid in the context of ocean warming. And shout out to my mentor, Charles Preddy, whose finger you can see up there, modeling just how tiny these paralarval squid look without a microscope. And I remember all our fieldwork brought us in and around La Jolla kelp forests, which if anyone remembers used to be so thick near the cove, you had to veer way off and take the long way south past Point La Jolla. Otherwise, you'd risk getting the boat stuck in some seriously thick kelp. And all that fun with squid soon opened the door to a job at NOAA, where before grad school, I got to research even more on squid, but this time alongside other important coastal and open ocean fisheries. But it didn't take long before I was ready to go back to school. So I started up my master's research, which brought me right back into the kelp forests. And along the way, I started working with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, doing abalone restoration work. And this is right about when I realized that what's probably a very obvious connection to us all now. See, no matter what the topic, every system or organism I've studied to date has all but collapsed in this same window. So if I'm the common denominator in all this, I mean, am I the problem? Is it me? I don't know. But needless to say, I do believe research focuses can be influenced by the major global themes that happen to be especially present during the infancy of a scientific career, and climate change has certainly inspired mine. So moving into my current field of study and how everything is connected, although I started working in this environment in the context of abalone restoration, I realized the foundation species itself is also at risk and deserves attention. Otherwise, there's no home for the abalone anyways, right? So more and more folks seem to know about kelp forests these days, which is exciting compared to even a few years ago. And I figured as people start hearing more about kelp forests, they're gonna start asking questions too. So I decided it was time to see how good our public resources are on this topic. So I asked ChatGPT, my first question ever, what is a kelp forest? And the response was pretty spot on, but I'll expand on it a little bit further here. Kelp forests are coastal cold water habitats dominated by large brown seaweeds, about 130 different species globally. They're hard-bottom dwellers that form dense three-dimensional stands, which creates a pretty unique habitat. So then I looked up what people would see if they asked about the importance of kelp forests. And most of the results in this were accurate too. They're the base of the food web and a habitat they create themselves, which also means they're important for fisheries and tourism. And if that's not enough, kelp is in your toothpaste, it's in your shampoo, your medicine, and even your favorite ice cream. And it's all because kelp contains a natural thickener that's fantastic at keeping things smooth and mixed. But there's some information out there on a topic that needs a little bit more clarification, and I wanna make sure we cover it here. And that's this idea of carbon sequestration. So I wanna highlight what we know about kelp and carbon. We know they're amazing fixers of carbon in that they're photosynthesizing all the time, taking in lots of CO2 as they grow. And we know that kelp grows super fast, which equates to a bunch of carbon storage. But there's this big question mark of how long that carbon is stored and ultimately where it all ends up once it enters or leaves the kelp system. So it's a complicated challenge and currently a growing area of research, but I need to stress that for that research to grow or even continue, it relies on kelp forests continuing to exist. So I want to review a familiar pair of problems, namely long-term and interannual climate change, especially in the local context here in San Diego. Climate change is affecting ocean conditions for kelp, and here's how they're changing in our backyard at UCSD. This is the temperature off the Scripps Pier over the last century, and we can see by the green line that it's generally increasing. And as a function of these elevated ocean temperatures, we can see range expansion of competitors and grazers has caused significant decline in the size and density of our Southern California kelp stands. In addition to the long-term increase due to anthropogenic climate change, the ENSO cycle creates these periods of warmer water and lower nutrient availability. So the red in this figure represents increased sea surface height, which corresponds to temperature increase during an El Nino. And when that happens on our coast, kelp are subject to thermal and nutrient stress. So for some context, before the 2015 El Nino, the all-time La Jolla kelp high was in 2013, with over 1 million square meters. That's 250 acres, or about 200 football fields, of canopy coverage. And then during the 2015 El Nino, La Jolla lost over 90% of its kelp, and it still hasn't recovered to anywhere near the values since back in 2013. So we know the patterns of loss observed here in La Jolla are also reflected across San Diego, the broader Eastern Pacific, and also globally, where it's motivated groups to begin restoration work. And recognizing the value of local action in a global context, we've formed a multidisciplinary team here in an effort to understand, reverse, or prevent further kelp loss in San Diego. So this is our team, where we have the pleasure of combining expertise across phycology and ecology here at UCSD under my advisor, Jen Smith, molecular biology over at Salk Institute with Todd Michael, developmental biology up at UCLA with Siobhan Braybrook, and kelp forest restoration ecology under Kane Layton at University of Tasmania. And I'd like to add that this collaboration also happens to represent part of my growing PhD thesis committee. So it's no coincidence that the goals of this project stem from my graduate research here at Scripps. So our work has four main objectives. First, we're looking at long-term kelp forest health as it changes through time, especially with habitat suitability for kelp transplants in mind. We're basically asking, how do rising ocean temperatures driven by climate change affect health and the dynamics of kelp beds in San Diego? Second, we're uncovering whether significant genomic diversity exists in San Diego kelp forests. Our question here being, do genetic variations in San Diego kelp beds impact their ability to withstand ocean warming? And third, we're testing how well local kelp tolerates environmental stress and whether there are any differences in performance across populations. In other words, how do the microscopic life stages of San Diego kelp respond to ocean heat waves? And given our growing kelp cultivation pipeline and seed banks, essentially our kelp nurseries, can we preserve kelp diversity before the next heat wave? And last, we're collecting field data at permanent monitoring sites that'll eventually support experimental kelp restoration. And here's where we want to know how transplanted kelp fare in new environments and whether there's any link to thermal tolerance we might find in our previous objective. And all of this work is ongoing at various stages in parallel. So going into some detail for these objectives, this map shows the kelp forest canopy at our permanent scuba monitoring sites in La Jolla, which we're now surveying on a seasonal basis. And explaining that panel, the teal area is anywhere that has ever had kelp between now and 1984. And white is where kelp was detected in 2022. Note that the MPA seen inside that dashed box also protects the southern half of La Jolla kelp forest, which we've consistently found to have higher persistence than in the northern regions of La Jolla. And it's this exact same pattern which motivated the distribution of our research sites, which are labeled by those black dots. And it's also where we hope to identify the community and environmental drivers that could be forcing the differences in recovery and persistence between these two regions of kelp. And all this is ahead of transplant experiments along the regions of North La Jolla, which historically had kelp, but have not recovered since the last El Nino. And a special shout out to Keenan Chan and Rich Walsh for helping me build out these sites for the summer. It was some serious work, and now we're on our way. So our second objective involves sequencing DNA from kelp across our local populations, which then reveals the level of diversity and potential for pre-existing stress tolerance among individuals. So essentially, what we're asking here is whether there's already an innate ability present in these populations to adapt to any degree of climate change. And that in turn can guide us in selecting natural kelp strains that might be more ideal for restoration work down the road. And an exciting aspect of this project is that we got to develop a giant kelp reference genome corresponding specifically to here in San Diego. And that's what we'll use to map all the local samples we collect as we start to catalog diversity in these populations. And here's a real-time sneak peek of what that diversity looks like with the few samples that we've already sequenced so far. So all you need to know for this figure is that every dot corresponds to an individual kelp. And the distance between each dot tells us how similar or different those kelp are across all the regions that we've sampled. So the closer the dots, the less genetic differences between the kelp. But the bottom line is, giant kelp in Southern California are proving to be genomically different, even within San Diego. which means there's a better chance we might find kelp out there that's already more tolerant to heat stress. So the third aspect we're tackling tests how well the early life stages of local kelp tolerates heat stress in the context of photophysiological, microscopic, and cellular level responses. And in the same process, it'll also determine the thermal thresholds for these populations in our backyard. So we'll focus our efforts on six seaweed taxa that represent the most abundant habitat-forming kelp species in San Diego. And from the ground up, this involves collecting reproductive material out in the kelp forest, growing it in the lab to create mother cultures and seed banks, essentially our nursery, before finally putting these specimens through growth experiments that simulate environmental stress on par with what they'd experience during a marine heat wave. And on top of the kelp nursery, on the topic of kelp nurseries for my research, it's been an absolute pleasure to work with Oriana, who's been documenting every detail and all the differences of my baby kelp from the very beginning. So yeah, thanks, Oriana. We don't often see or think of this tiny life stage when it comes to kelp, but they're just so darn cute, like little potato chips or basil leaves. And they've even got these tiny little holdfasts. I love it. And so all this work feeds into our final objective, which tests restoration techniques in La Jolla, focusing specifically on Macrocystis or giant kelp. And we're testing its performance in the context of all the data we're collecting in our previous objectives. So revisiting those transplant sites I introduced in our first objective, they all share two main ground truth criteria. First, they're at a depth of about 15 meters or 50 feet with consistent hard bottom reef structure. And second, they'd previously hosted thriving kelp forests, but now they're largely devoid of giant kelp. So following methods tested in previous restoration experiments by Leighton and Johnson in Tasmania, we'll experimentally outplant kelp grown on polycarbonate tiles fastened to the seafloor with expansion bolts, all in spatial arrangements that are comparable to their natural kelp densities. Ultimately, this last aspect should uncover if the health and survivorship of juvenile Macrocystis are related to either their thermal tolerance or their genetic line. So collectively, we've set up the project such that these findings could inform future kelp restoration efforts, particularly in regions affected by heat stress-induced kelp decline. So the work started a few years ago with early support from some UCSD seed funds, along with an AAUS scholarship. And as the project gained momentum, we received a C-Trees research grant to expand the work. And all of that just landed Sea Grant's 2024 support for accelerating kelp research and restoration in California. So we're excited about the funding and equally excited to share an upcoming update on CDFW permitting. We've had a specific use permit application in process for upwards of the last year, and now it's in the final stages. So we'll need this permit in place to start experimental restoration and to collect more DNA samples from across San Diego's protected areas. So we've definitely made some significant strides, humbly starting from a repurposed mini fridge for all the kelp culturing before we advance to dedicated incubators. And alongside, we've refined our DNA techniques to craft a San Diego Macrocystis reference genome. And all this progress underpinned by Sea Grant funding has been amplified by the strong support of a global community and positive engagement with the Birch Aquarium, the Kelp Forest Alliance, and the Nature Conservancy, to name a few. So we're now set for the next phase of this work, eagerly awaiting Sea Grant funding to come in and the scientific permit approval. And that'll let us scale up this kelp biomass that we're trying to collect, all for the upcoming heat stress experiments, the DNA sequencing, and our transplant trials. So I know a bit of this talk has been pretty heavy in terms of extreme events and ocean warming, but there is this silver lining that I want to leave you with. And it's that these same environmental downers can actually help select for tolerance to the climate stressors that characterize extreme events. So populations that have undergone the selection could be used as targets for restoration, which will boost climate resilience in our natural populations. And this work will hopefully demonstrate how selection might be happening in our local kelp forests out here in our backyard. And it'll build a record of local population diversity as it potentially fluctuates with each environmental perturbation. So I hope reframing this perception of climate extremes as opportunities for developing resilience might inspire and direct our ongoing efforts in the context of kelp restoration. And in closing, sincerely heartfelt thanks to the Holdfast team and the Birch Aquarium for having me here today, and to everyone who came here tonight to be a part of this steadily growing kelp culture. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming tonight. Thank you, Mo, for setting the stage so well with such a great representation of your work. I'm Oriana Poindexter. I'm a photo-based artist and a marine scientist working at the intersection of science, art, and the ocean. I've always been most comfortable in the water, and my favorite way to communicate is to collect and share fragments of the natural world. I studied biology and visual arts as an undergraduate at Princeton. I fell in love with photography as a way to create an image of something that I'd found out in nature and the tangible physical craft of black and white darkroom printing. The magic of chemistry and light, the alchemy of watching the moment in time be transferred to paper, the image surfacing through the developer. When I moved down to San Diego just over a decade ago, I quickly landed at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography just down the hill. I was sucked into the orbit of SIO by the marine collections. There's hundreds of thousands of jars with preserved marine organisms, each of which contains the story of an individual, a fish, a worm, a snail, the place it came from, and the person who collected and studied it. The exhibit that Holdfast replaced, called Oddities, was a celebration of these marine collections and contained some of these photographs. I've photographed hundreds of specimens from the Scripps collections, attempting to find the good side of a snail fish, creating the portraits with dignity for each of these creatures that have been pulled from the depths to join the scientific record. I've always been a swimmer, but I started surfing and diving in earnest here in San Diego in 2013 and 2014, when the kelp canopy was at its historic height. Diving from shore, free diving and scuba diving from shore in those years, I began to develop a relationship with these local spots. Each one has a distinct personality, with a certain set of inhabitants, characteristics, behaviors, underwater landscapes, and things to watch for. When I first started diving in giant kelp, it was pretty easy to find. Dense, amber, and full of life. I've been photographing in the kelp for a decade now. I started photographing with a 35mm film camera underwater, the Nikonos 3. Cameras and the tools of photography are a license of a kind, a ticket for me to get outside and go exploring. Taking it underwater, one breath at a time, let me begin to learn about the kelp forest and all the creatures that call it home. The kelp forest can be a difficult place to make a picture, however. The conditions are not always ideal. Sometimes you can't see more than a few feet in front of you. Like many photographers, I had images in my head that I wanted to capture and kept trying for. One of these imaginary pictures was an evenly lit stand of giant kelp from top to bottom, so you could see the whole thing, all of the details, all of the scale. If you dive in the kelp, you know this is impossible. There's a single natural light source in the ocean, and it's the sun, and it comes in very unilateral direction. After the marine heat wave of 2014 and 2015, and the multiple years of summer water temperatures hitting 80 degrees, the kelp started getting harder to find. I had to swim farther from shore, testing some dive buddy relationships beyond their limits as I wanted to swim out farther and farther, almost to the forest. I swear it's just past that buoy. One day in July 2018, off of Encinitas, I took the picture that I had in my head. The water had gotten so hot that the kelp was literally melting. Its buoyant nematocysts had dissolved away, releasing their gas into the water. The tall stand of kelp had gone from tall and vertical to long and horizontal, laying down flat at the bottom of the ocean. I hovered over it and snapped this picture, delighted at my find. It wasn't until later that I put all the pieces together, realizing why this picture had come into being and what that meant. The more time I spent in the kelp, the more I realized how integral it was to be thinking about the entire ecosystem, and that there was a disconnect between a lot of the fisheries and conservation work that was the focus of my time at my work at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration for a number of years, missing the forest for the trees. The feeling I wanted to communicate was one of awe, one of wonder, the feeling of being small, of being a visitor, a witness to something so much bigger, stronger, older, more powerful, and more important than you or I. Some people find the seeking out of this feeling to be strange, scary, or dark, but but I think it's critical to find it and experience it in your own way. For me, visiting the forest and finding this feeling is an experience of joy. It's a revelation to apply the abilities that I'm lucky to possess. The ability to enter the water, to kick my legs and hold my breath and open my eyes, and to use these abilities to bear witness to the world of individuals below the surface. It's a world without cell phones, without emails, without calendar notifications. It's a world full of creatures, interconnected neighbors, and relationships between locals and visitors. It's a world entirely beyond my control, and that I can only enter when the conditions are right, and when the unspoken acceptance, and with the unspoken acceptance of the risk that's represented by crossing that threshold. I'm often asked how I came up with the idea to create cyanotypes of seaweed. This is not a new idea. Cyanotype, or sun printing, is a really early form of photography, invented in the 1840s. It utilizes a combination of two iron salts that become sensitive to UV light when mixed in the right proportion. It doesn't require a dark room or even a camera. It exposes in sunlight, and it requires only water to process the resulting image and create an archival print. And I'm not the first one to combine it with seaweeds either. Anna Atkins did that in England in 1843. She created the first book of photographs in the world, and they're cyanotypes of seaweed. About 5 years ago, I realized that I could use cyanotype chemistry to make images not just of the kelp, but with the kelp. And that if I could find paper or fabric big enough, that I could make an image with the kelp at kelp size. I could make an image like the one I had photographed in 2018 of the melted, evenly lit, laying down kelp, but without having to wait for a devastating heat wave. I've been dreaming about making this silk forest since that day. It was just a figment of my imagination for years, even as I started telling friends, first in whispers, could you imagine a forest of cyanotypes? Kelp-sized, big enough to swim through. Then I started writing it down, daring to include it in proposals that kept going nowhere. It takes a lot to build a forest. I came to the aquarium with the idea for this show last year. This is Megan wearing one of the early samples, as one does. And I'm in the background making the print. I'm still in shock that this forest actually exists. It's been an absolute joy and privilege to have met and collaborated with Megan and the whole exhibits team here to craft this exhibit from the proposal that I had presented. As soon as I met Megan and dared to show her a small sample of the silk cyanotype, she saw the forest. No more explanation needed. I made the images that you see in the exhibit in the 6 weeks between Thanksgiving and New Year's of 2023. I created 9 original pieces, one-of-a-kind cyanotypes on panels of paper, ranging in size from 12.5 to 16.5 feet long and 3 feet wide. To make each image, I first mixed the chemistry and painted onto the paper at night in my studio. The next day, I go freediving in the kelp forest outside of the marine protected areas at some of the same sites that Mo uses as field sites, looking for exactly the right specimen. I look around the forest for individuals that speak to me, and some days I don't find what I'm looking for. Each piece is truly a collaboration with the environment, the conditions, and what the ocean is willing to allow me to collect. I select individual strands of kelp that are as large as the paper I have prepared. So for these, I was collecting pieces 12 to 16 feet long in the ocean. I break off one strand from the larger individual, like taking a single branch from a tree, and then return to the surface. I put the piece in my bag and then swim back to shore. Back at my studio, I pull the kelp from my bag and carefully pat dry each and every blade. I get to know the specimen this way, as an individual. In the crowd, in the forest, they all appear quite similar, but each one is unique in the way people are. I carefully lay the kelp out over the light-sensitive paper I prepared, composing a portrait of the strand of kelp in a way that will capture both the scale and the details that make that individual unique. When it's right, I pull the paper with the kelp over it into sunlight, where the exposure is created. Anything covered up by the kelp stays lighter in color, while any part of the paper fully exposed to the light turns dark blue. The exposure time depends on the intensity of the sun, usually between 10 and 20 minutes. After exposing, I return the whole situation to the shade, remove the kelp, and wash the image in water to process it. For this exhibit, we chose to use reproductions instead of originals to create something safe, immersive, and interactive. We digitized those original prints I showed earlier at life-size scale and printed them on 100% silk to create the 27 hanging panels that you can see, touch, and swim through today. The paper originals are still safe in a box at my studio if anybody wants to see them. Each cyanotype photogram that I make is a portrait of that individual. By recording the time, place, and species of each specimen I collect, I'm creating a collected portrait of that place, allowing each specimen to image itself in this light-sensitive material. The three small pieces that you see when you first enter the exhibit over here are photograms made with giant kelp, but not with kelp that I collected in the ocean. These three pieces are made with six-month-old giant kelp babies, sporophytes grown by Mohammed Cetera in the lab just down the hill. You can see the individual variation, the differences in size of individuals of the same age, and the first growth of what will become a holdfast on each one. The blue ones are cyanotypes made with the same chemistry as the large silks. And the pink one is a lumen print. It's a different chemistry, but it's the same idea of kelp over light-sensitive paper in the sun. I create this work because I love the experience of making it. It's an experience that brings me joy. To enter the ocean, to leave daily life at the shoreline, and unburden myself in the water. To experience the beauty and the terror of life underwater, and to bear witness to the changes that we are causing. To create a document of that experience and to make it relevant to the scientific record in my own way. I'm often asked what I want people to take away from my work, and I have trouble answering that question. If I'm making it for anyone, it's for the forest, for the individuals whose portraits are being created. This is my own relationship with the ocean, with the forest, and it manifests in these images. The fact that the pictures, the original unique objects, can go on to have a life where they interact with you and can get you excited about this environment is an incredible bonus. If I'm pushed to answer the question, I hope that the work can inspire awe for the marine environment and a desire to go develop your own relationship with nature, whatever form that takes for you. It's still really surreal to see this exhibit come to life in such a complete way. This is the third time I've had the opportunity to show my work alongside the Gyotaku work of Dwight Hwang, whose individual portraits of fish, lobster, crabs, and seaweed bring the cyanotype forest to life. The exhibit has evolved to include the creativity of the entire team. It takes a village to build a forest, and this one exists thanks to Megan Dickerson, Dwight Hwang, Rob Rad, Tina Mao, Mohammed Cetera, Jen Smith, Marianne Beister, and Adi Ken, just to name a few. I'll leave you with this. There's a sister exhibit on view through April 21st at the UC San Diego Geisel Library, just up the hill, and I had the honor of curating this exhibit, Ebb and Flow, Giant Kelp Forest Through Art, Science, and the Archives, which includes 36 works by four artists, Dwight Hwang, Marie McKenzie, Julia C.R. Gray, and myself, in dialogue with 25 original seaweed pressings made by scientists and citizens with seaweed collected in La Jolla between 1890 and 2023. So if you want more seaweed, there's plenty more. thank you, and I look forward to more questions.
Again, I'm Megan Dickerson, Director of Exhibits, and I can't believe I get to work with these people. I'm so in love with this project and this work. I mean, hopefully you feel that too, the passion, the joy, all while we're doing something that's really challenging, you know? I think a lot about what Catherine Hayhoe wrote about rational hope, if you're familiar with her work. And I want to read it before we start the discussion. So she writes that her hope is not based on burying my head in the sand or practicing positive thinking. My hope begins with looking at how bad this is. True hope, rational hope, muscular hope, begins with looking clear-eyed at just how bad it is, just how high the risk is, how small the chance of success is. Hope is that small chance, however improbable, of something better. How we get there is recognizing that it's not guaranteed, but it's possible. And the only way it's possible is if we do everything we can. Does anybody feel that? You know, where it's both the, I'm looking at both of your work and the feeling of being in the kelp forest and being with nature, which we hope we've simulated through the experience here, right? The feeling of looking at baby kelp, which I never thought I'd think were so cute. I had this sort of squee moment every time I see them. I'm just like, baby kelp, right? But at the same time, understanding that there's this great risk and this great challenge. So I don't know how to do small talk, so I'm just gonna go straight into that. How do you balance that? How do you balance in your work the knowledge that you have? Like the work that you've done, Mo, that every animal that you've studied, you know, has been impacted by climate in the last 10 years. How do you balance that joy and that reality at the same time? You're welcome.
Thank you so much. So that keeps me going. That it's a love-hate situation for sure. And some of that was, I only realized some of the impact that climate change has had on these previous projects I was chatting about very recently. It was almost like a retrospective realization that, oh yeah, though this has definitely influenced every step I've made, every turn that I've made to get to this point. So, you know, I wouldn't be here without it, which is both amazing, but also it's a scary driving force, right, that we're here. And I think that I'm not the only one that's having this experience, which is also what keeps me going. I mean, here I'm sitting next to another example. We're all noticing and reacting. We're acting in a direction that reacts to what climate change has, how climate change has affected all of these different organisms, these ecosystems that we're studying. So yeah, I guess it's a catalyst for everything that I do.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it as a catalyst. And for me, I had a job where I was ostensibly working in that direction, but it didn't feel impactful to me. And so I just started diving more and just doing these things that felt good to me physically of diving, of creating these images. And then the fact that they can go on and be seen and create these conversations and then create the opportunity to have these discussions was not my intention at the beginning. It's been a really wonderful surprise.
Well, I was thinking a little bit earlier about how you both are people who pay attention. And that's the work of artists. I think that's where artists and scientists really intersect.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? It's just noticing, and what you notice might be a little bit different. I think as scientists, you're trained to focus on that one thing, whether it's squid or abalone, you know, and you're not seeing the bigger picture, right? So have you had any challenges in pushing that forward to see the forest for the trees?
Definitely. But it helps to just make the time and go observe and make the time to go observe without an agenda necessarily. To try to see it with fresh eyes. And then I think that's when you have the opportunity to see something new.
Yeah, that's a really good point. With the abalone research, realizing that they're living in an environment that is soon going to be at even more risk compared to the ability themselves. That was a big, like, oh, okay, we can zoom out and recognize there is a forest for the trees situation here. So sometimes it slaps you in the face and you realize when you're just way too focused under a microscope or underwater looking way too close to the seafloor. So, yeah. It's definitely a nice perspective.
It's kind of like, so if you've seen the baby kelp that are growing in the refrigerator in Holdfast, and I was mentioning how kids are obsessed with it and they're staring at it, just watching it like it's a screen almost, you know, and they're watching all these tiny little movements. And I told this to Mo, and Mo was like, well, that's basically what I do all day. It's a bit of an intersection, right? You know, it's just noticing. I think that I was making this other triple Venn diagram of artists, scientists, and children, being aware and paying attention to the world around us. So what was your transition, though, that moved you away from, was there a story that made you move away from the specifics to really thinking about the habitat? Was there a moment that you can look back to?
Not a specific moment in time, but I was just thinking, actually, when you were just answering that last question, I went, I learned to scuba dive more kind of, I learned scientific scuba diving very early on in my scuba diving career, and you're taught to have a task underwater, which is great. You are very focused on that task. And for a long time, that task was like, find as many abalone as possible. And so you're on the bottom and you're looking underneath everything and you're not looking up almost ever. And I went scuba diving recently with a group of artists. And usually I go free diving with artists. I don't go scuba diving with artists. And we went scuba diving and I went straight to the bottom looking for abalone. And I lost my buddies because they stayed halfway down the kelp, down the water column, taking in the forest. And I was at the bottom. I was like, what are you guys doing? We got to look for stuff. So, yeah, I don't know if that directly answers your question, but that was a moment relatively recently where I realized kind of a mental switch of observation and of experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in that moment, you were still reevaluating.
Yeah, I put the science gear back on. I put the scuba diving stuff back on, mm-hmm. and I was back in like science head.
Mm. You're in very science head right now, PhD student. Yeah. I mean, how do you go in and out of it? Do you kind of go back and forth?
Oriana definitely brings me out of it in a really good way when we intersect. And awesome. And a little aside, there's a phycology class that Jen teaches, my advisor, at UCSC every other year. And we're all in this class right now together, kind of going through it and enjoying. So it's been a nice way to interact and think about all the seaweed that is around me when I'm doing my science, but also in a different perspective. I like to think, I don't think I've told you this, but when we're in class and I see you working with the specimens, I try to think, okay, like what's going on in Oriana's head right now? Like what perspective does she have? And that sometimes helps me reframe what my approach is as well. Because you also have the scientific background as well. And you've mixed that very nicely with the visual art form as well. So it's definitely a role model in that sense too.
I'm learning a lot in seaweed class.
I'm learning a lot from what you're learning in seaweed class. I mean, it just kind of...
It's like a chain up the hill.
Exactly. She'll come in like, did you know this? And this one's so cute. No, I'm talking about seaweed is cute. This is a real sea change for me, you know, like moving from my other work to suddenly thinking, oh my goodness, plankton and seaweed are so cute. But I mean, maybe you're saying that we should have an artist embedded in every class, you know, just every science class, right? To help you see things a little bit differently. And maybe the opposite is true too, you know, having scientists in art class. Yeah. I mean, that's your background, right? Your degree is similar to that, I mean, from Princeton, right?
Yeah. I've always had this kind of, wanting to be on both sides of the science and the art equation and never quite understanding why I'm supposed to choose one. I've been lucky to kind of find a path where I can combine the two of them. I think historically, you know, in the 1840s, 1850s, as these art processes were being invented and photography wasn't really around, scientists were expected to be artists also. They had to illustrate what they were finding. That was the only way to communicate it. And at some point that has kind of separated as technology has evolved and we, you know, scientists are still expected to be many different things, but artists is no longer one of them necessarily. So I've always felt that they are very interconnected and come from the same curiosity. And like you were saying earlier, just this need to observe nature. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sorry, I get distracted because there's so many good conversations that have happened. I also want to, by the way, point out if he's here, Itamar Lilienthal, where are you? There you are. Okay, so Ita is the maker of the giant kelp lantern, if you saw it. So if you haven't had a chance to go in the exhibit, it's right there. Some of you may be able to see it from your seats. It's entirely made of giant kelp. Everything, right? No non-kelp. And a lot of it was harvested from what we were moving out of our own kelp tank here. So I think that there's, you know, in addition to this conversation of where the arts and sciences intersect, it's also where does that go, right? Ita's also working on a kelp-based paint, you know? So I think that this exhibit here is about being in the space, about marinating in it, about having conversations in the kelp forest, right? But it's also about inspiring what more might be done. Right? That's my favorite definition of play, is what more might be done, what more might happen. And I know we want to open up to some questions. Yeah.
This is mostly for Muhammad, I think. Can you talk about the effect of the warming of the water on sea urchins and the impact of them on the sea, on the holdfasts? In addition to the plant itself being affected by the hotter water.
Yeah, great. So if anyone's aware, in Northern California, around the same time that we've been talking, there was a series of heat waves, and the kelp forests that were up in Northern California on the North Coast all also melted away, like Oriana mentioned in her talk. And the waters did eventually cool down a bit, and what we would have expected was the kelp to return to that area. But instead, it did shift, and it shifted into an urchin barren. So this is a situation where the seafloor is covered by a disproportionately high amount of urchins compared to any other organism on the seafloor, including abalone, including kelp that they love to eat. And so when the waters get warmer or they stay warmer, this, in a nutshell, can reduce the predation effort that it removes the predators on urchins that you would find in these environments. Some of that is because of disease. So like certain types of sea stars, like the one that we just heard about earlier today, got wiped out when the water got warmed. And they usually keep the urchin population in control. They're one of the players in that. So a lot fell apart in that. And this is what led to the urchins to be able to explode the way they did. And I guess just touching on it again, but you asked about what temperature does to kelp itself. I mean, at some point there's a threshold where it just starts to melt away. But before it gets to that crazy red line, it's a paired issue. When the water starts to rise or the water is generally warmer, that also usually equates to lower nutrients in the water column, which the kelp is hungry for all the time. It grows so fast, it grows so fast per day that we can actually describe the rate of growth of giant kelp in miles per hour. It's like 0.2 miles per hour, but we can see it essentially almost with our naked eye. And so that means it's very hungry. It needs nutrients. And so usually our coastal systems are, at least here in California especially, there is the presence of a very strong upwelling current that brings deeper, cold, nutrient-rich waters. And so we can't have one without the other. When the waters are warm, that generally also means there's less nutrients for the kelp to even do its thing. So it's usually nutrients tend to be the problem first, and as the temperatures get even warmer, it's just all bets are off and stuff starts to melt.
So thank you for a great presentation. I love the format. I love how engaged you are. This is amazing, okay? My question has to do with internal waves and tidal forcing in the canyons, which might bring colder water up into the kelp beds. I was wondering if you see any spatial relationship with the canyons and this forcing function. Thank you.
Why haven't we talked earlier? This is great. So there's a couple of papers that came out recently, not too long ago, like in 2012, about La Jolla's kelp patch especially, and that submarine canyon just north of that extent in the cove. And you're absolutely right, like you're hitting the nail on the head. But what they also found when they started checking the temperature in the water column across all of La Jolla, like from north to south, they found that on average, temperatures closer to the canyon, so towards the north of La Jolla's footprint, were actually like a little bit warmer than what you'd find further away from the submarine canyon in the south. And that has exactly to do what they describe as with internal waves. So the high amplitude internal waves traveling out of the canyon, which is what lets them get essentially so tall, if you will, that mixes the water column so well right when it comes out the gates out of the canyon that the warmer waters near the surface of what the kelp forest experience gets mixed really well with the deeper, normally colder waters. And that causes this whole environment, like from surface to seafloor, to be just a little bit warmer. And that's crazy for me. I mean, that's got my attention, because in heat wave events, what's already a little bit of a warmer part of, at least in the Hoya's kelp forest, might get that much more warm. So you wonder, like, are the kelp that are living there or trying to live adapted to that warmer environment? So are they actually okay? Or are they just barely hanging on normally? And as soon as there's a heat wave event, they're the first ones to go, you know? So I don't know, but great. That was almost like a planted question. That's so good. So thank you. Yeah.
Okay, I have a question. Years ago, we had Kelco that had a fleet of kelp cutters, and at that time they claimed they worked on the health of the kelp beds. Have you seen any evidence of what happened while they were working and what has happened since then as affecting the comings and goings of the kelp beds?
So right around 20, again, everything's 2013. Where were you in 2013? What did the kelp look like too? I remember right around when I was finishing up this squid project that I was talking about, their kelco was still very present here off La Jolla, off of our coast in San Diego. And it, like, I didn't even think twice about it. There was that much kelp for them to collect. It was dense. It didn't see, they were just, you know, shaving off the surface. It seemed like it was fine. I don't know about what, like, I don't know if that's all talk or if that's actually true. I never saw anything about that, but it also wasn't the height of my time in the kelp forest. I was in and around it, but I was studying squid, you know, I was studying abalone. I never saw them doing much more than collecting kelp, which at the time was perfectly, you know, it wasn't just sustainable. It almost maybe was a good, it was like volcanoes coming through, causing that disturbance maybe actually promoted the health. So unless that was the angle they were working, we're shaving, we're pruning the leaves, you know, and we're inspiring new growth. Unless that was the angle, I'm not too sure there was much more going on. Yeah. But now they're further south. They're in Mexico now. There's really not much here for them. You saw in those figures. So, you know, we can ask them the next time they come back north, right? But.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.